the proposal that we must put that as an option. And then, of course, the current rules and the disease, my bias is, of course, is clear that it's for a quorum. Seven members of all parties that sit in that committee can fail to have three in quorum. Even if we don't want to take Parliament very seriously, I think the quorum. My view, though, was that we should just put that the meeting starts when there's a quorum. Then they'll ask whether they don't like that we shouldn't assist them to remain in the rule that I think is not useful. Yeah.
I'm so worried about us putting that into the rules because that's going to give them all more reason to go and pull in other people to get a quorum. Are there any things that we need to allow people to speak with the person and with each other to not make a decision? Other assembly member. In other words, it must be either the member or the alternative, and take up the co-option of any other assembly member. myself as no problem with the court.
Yeah. Good court is remained for that purpose. When a member is not there, the notary's member must attend. But the problem that the member is not there, alternate is not there, then you have to pick people on the street, really, or the former quorum.
Then you delete one people.
No.
No.
Right.
Then you say
the
member not there, then
the alternative is. Yeah. You
don't say, you don't carry on to say,
all co-ops. Yes, but sorry, with respect, if
if
the member is not there,
then
there
is no one.
Then obviously the alternative could be there.
Yeah.
But then there is no need for a one-team
four. Correct.
No.
Are we proposing to omit 1, 3, 4? There may be circumstances in which during the course of a long meeting one or two members have to leave and decisions have to be taken, and then they, but then it has to be members from the same party who are co-opted to enable the decisions to be taken. It would be a facilitating measure, but I don't know if we want it at all now. I'm not clear.
Chairperson, I will reluctantly agree to members of the same party, because I fully agree with what you are saying. The time has come that we should really take Parliament seriously, and that we don't just call meetings and cancel and call meetings and cancel. And if members have a proper program, and they can, in fact, Chairperson, one of our good friends from Gauteng Legislature has resigned because she could no longer stand from the majority party. Resigned because she could no longer stand the calling and cancellation of meetings at the whim of, you know, Loretta Jacobs. She said to me she thinks Parliament is getting from bad to worse, and there's no structure and there's no centre that holds. And this is why, because we are so open and accommodating, etc. We're not structured enough.
We've got another bit of problem we can have here. We talk about members of small parties saying that they can attend all meetings, participate, that they can't vote. And yet they're saying that members that have perhaps never attended that meeting can come in and vote. That's contradictory. It's seriously problematic.
You must put in after a long discussion, I think Cuthbert and I sat on the committee when you first put in, on the subcommittee when you first put in. And we were crippling the functional committees. We were crippling at the time. And I remember this rule very deliberately when it came up and why it was put in. It was put in to expedite the working of the committee. If 19 years later we have an alternate way of expediting the working of a committee, then we can consider that. But I want to also, if we were to consider anything of the co-opting, shouldn't we be considering the appointment of alternates? Because alternates should be appointed. In other words, you have a member, for that member you have an alternate. And that should be presented to the ATC before the time. Yeah. You want to change something there to make it more flexible to appoint alternates instead of what we have here. That could work.
Okay.
About 3 weeks ago we had a rules and because there wasn't a quorum, those minutes could not be adopted. So we proceeded with the business until members were pulled in from wherever. And then when we got a quorum, those minutes were then adopted. Make some mockery of what we are doing in this committee. Last week on Wednesday and Thursday, a two-day workshop for the SADC PF was organized. And 50 members confirmed that they would be attending, and four people were flown in from Namibia to conduct the workshop. And the workshop was supposed to start at 9 o'clock. I got there at 9 o'clock. And there were three members of the opposition and two members of the ANC. And five members of a possible confirmed 50 with invited guests from outside of the country. And the meeting could not start at 9 o'clock. It eventually started at 5 past 10. later on they managed to just pull in people who were just hanging around or whatever. They sent taxis to Acacia and so on and so forth. But the bottom line is that was a two-day planned workshop. It became a two-hour workshop. And it's a disgrace. It boils down to discipline, boils down to, you know, lack of commitment. You spoke about the fact that we members of parliament, mm-hmm. and that's the work that we are here to do. But just to go back to the rules issue, I mean, can you convince the speaker that we can't co-opt members in order to facilitate his meeting, which is the rules meeting that we needed to take an urgent decision on? And people who haven't even been part of that, I think it was about the motion of no confidence, it had to be referred, you know, for consideration to the rules committee, and it had to be done, you know, with the quorum there. Now, we are making some decisions here, but, you know, it's the people at the top also who have to buy into an amendment of this nature.
Okay,
that's one.
Okay. Thank you, Jason. We have a major problem here. This is a serious lack of discipline. I don't see how changing the co-option is going to actually help a situation like that, quite frankly. What we perhaps need to consider is, and it's something that we automatically did when I say we, when I was still a member of the Culture Freedom Party, smaller party, is we perhaps need to say two alternatives for every member. So that you're nominating so-and-so or so-and-so as an alternative to so-and-so. Then you've got more to call upon. But I do not think we can call people in cold. I really think that's more of an insult than anything else to the parliamentary work. So rather, look at bringing in two alternatives to every committee member. And you know, you've then got a number of alternatives from which to call if you have a problem. But I honestly think bringing in ordinary co-opted members from the cold like this is a disaster, really. I'd appeal to you to think very carefully about it.
Should
we run it
another point?
I think that is actually taking us forward, because I do believe that, first of all, I was under the impression all along that all parties nominate a primary member and an alternate for every committee, and that is published as such in the ACC. And usually when we adjust the committee representation, then we submit it to the speaker to say that this one, the alternative is now going to be the primary member and the other members are going to be alternative or whatever. So I was under the impression that that is usually formally done. On some committee attendance register, you will actually see reflected an alternate member and the name of the alternate member. And I think that is how it should be done. Because it must be transparent and it must be consistent. And everybody should know who are those members. But coming back, if we then say, fine, the ANC primary members are as follows, and the following members are nominated as the alternate,
correct.
As a pool of alternates.
Correct.
And then say for instance, if a party has one member, then at least two alternates. Then we actually build up a pool of alternative members, but not just any person to be pulled in, and that we restricted to that so that at least those people are more or less au fait with what is to be discussed in a committee.
Okay.
Every principal should consider that, and if it is rejected, of course, we'll redraft it again. And I don't think any harm on it. But I think there will be main members and alternates. I think even if they're not that the government party, I'm not sure what is happening now, maybe it's not appearing in all committees. There will be a list of colleagues who are alternates. These are three members. Anyway, we've got three members who are alternates from the ANC. you can take that members anytime when there's a problem. And then there are people who are part, many of them say they attend this meeting as if they are main members, because they like some of these committees. I think just to emphasize the point. And then I think what we are doing is to persuade people not to call as people when you are busy eating there, just come to form a quorum for the decision to be made. I think it's not correct. You know. I think that's what we want to get rid of.
Yes.
But we can call all alternatives if they're there, they should come, and then we'll form a quorum. But we can't just anyone who's available. In fact, some of the committees must wait, because some members of the committee must be taken out of the committee to go and form a quorum there, there was an agent there. Then they'll come back. I think it can't work that way. Generally speaking, it shouldn't work that way.
Just section 157. Can we just go back there? Should we not bring in 157 where we speak of the alternate, then perhaps make a specific provision that parties should nominate a minimum of two alternates? Something like that. So that we capture it somewhere. Otherwise, 126 deals with appointment procedure, and 127 deals with alternates. And unless we capture it there, we may actually lose it altogether. So I don't know if that is the correct place, but I would suggest that we consider that.
Okay. I think that's
Are we talking about two alternates per member?
No.
That's what you're saying. Just two alternates for that party in that committee.
We need more than that.
No,
we don't have.
If I can just say, the problem doesn't lie in what we don't have. The problem is not having the whole of parties. The problem is, in fact, with the majority party. Because you have a quorum if the majority party approves. That's the point. So what we're saying is two is not really sufficient. I think in the case of the majority party, they need to appoint at least an alternate for every committee member. That is the only way you're going to ensure that there are sufficient alternates to come in. But we are saying that you should be trying to put in, you should be allowed to put in up to a maximum of two per member. I think that's maybe what we need to do.
Can you can't write the rules for the present situation. I think that's what Mr. Seaton is saying. You can't presume that the ANC, they might well do, are going to have 264 members forever. You can't write rules just for the present. You've got to write rules for the future. So how it's worded is very important for me.
The rules are quite general. I think that they allow parties to adopt whatever policies they like. The rules don't restrict parties from appointing two alternates per member, I don't think. Alternates may be appointed for one or more specific members of a committee. Does that mean that they can't appoint two?
No,
they can. So long as the point is captured in our documentation, and that the parties are aware of it.
Okay, that's similar to your fine now.
Yes, if I could just say one last thing. I think it comes back to, as I recall, when Anne certainly was here, alternates also got copies of all the documentation that went to the mayor.
Yeah.
And it's up to the alternates to ensure that they read that documentation. I certainly did. When I was an alternate on a committee, I made sure that I was fully in favour of that particular committee as well. And I think it is the responsibility of all members to ensure they are. So then we're in the best situation that we are at present.
The alternate should be encouraged to attend even if the full member is present, because they can have
one member
from that in terms of being on top.
I know that in other committees, what's her name, they also attend.
Yeah.
They just come to a meeting, they attend, they enjoy some of those meetings, and I think we'll allow them to do so. And then we'll rewrite one day before then, accordingly. I think corruption is general. And then 135 is
truly
a good place. And I know that will be fired every committee meeting.
135. Why? Because you're the structure of things. Okay, I would love it for you to catch me up. I was just wondering, it's good that you say no change to date for resumption of business. But there's one problem that I have, and again, you don't want to make rules for administrative complexity. I assume it's not the right thing.
provided that proper notice is given. Why I'm saying that is sometimes members are not receiving proper notice. Now, I know it's not necessarily on the committee side. It can be at the documentation clerk side or whatever. But I know that some of the documentation is sometimes not reaching the members in time. And then they object because they're not aware of it, etc. So I'm just wondering, is there anything that was a rule or a sort of a standard procedure that, like, for instance, an ATC is published before a matter is discussed in the House? Now, is there anything that determines how committees should function so that members are always aware of where they should be and what time and when? Because currently, many things are changed at the very last minute, and members are running around to the wrong venue, etc.
Okay.
Kevin, from my understanding, is that there's a committee list that is sent out to the members that determines what committees will take place. Now, assuming that they're not being changed and delayed, I believe that this is a responsibility of an individual. If they haven't received the agenda and documentation for a meeting that is taking place tomorrow to ensure they get it today, I think the members have got certain responsibilities themselves. And so I think that is something that does need to be looked at. I have a little bit of a problem, though, with 135. The member presiding at the meeting of the committee may interrupt or suspend the proceedings. The adjourning the meeting is not a major problem because it's done ahead of time. But may suspend or interrupt. For what reason? What reason would give rise to that? I think we need to be precise there. Otherwise, the chairman decides, I need the day for today. I'm going to suspend this meeting. And we've got to be careful why suspensions or interruptions take place. So I just think maybe there needs to be a little more in there.
Just on that last point, it's of course difficult to know what circumstances may arise that would lead to suspension. I can recall one example where temperatures were very high in the committee, and the chair very thoughtfully suspended business for 10 minutes to let members cool down and then continue. So you can't perhaps codify all the reasons that may arise, but I think you can certainly hold the committee chair responsible as the committee chair at a whim and for no acceptable reason start suspending or adjourning meetings. I wanted to come back to the last part of that particular rule, which says, and may change the date for the resumption of business. I am aware of committee meetings having been set and of witnesses being called in from Victoria and all over, flying down to Cape Town for the meeting, and within the last 24 hours, the meeting is suddenly doesn't happen. And the members already, those people already committed, they've bought their tickets, and there's all kinds of expenses, quite far from the embarrassment and the media's interest and so on. So maybe it's necessary to introduce something in the rules in terms of time frames within which you may still cancel a meeting and so on.
Okay, I think we should look at something then. Because it will protest also generally that department who comes in.
Yeah. It would be very bad for a department. They've prepared everything, important CV, book a venue, test time. And then 12 hours down the line, they're told that the meeting is cancelled. Madam?
So there's a provision just administratively, I think, for committees to apply for permission for meetings and special meetings from the House Chair. The chairperson of the other committees. Would one not then in this case also for where meetings have to be cancelled at short notice? Or if they're not, in other words, you stipulate a period within which committees may be cancelled, and then if there's any exception to that rule, it can only be done by with the permission of the House Chairperson, because the House Chairperson would be in a position to yay or nay out. And also they would be. That would be sort of Parliament saying it's okay for this meeting, in other words, endorsing the decision, and that is for good reason.
Just another point we might want to take into account, just a drafting style. We we talk about the chairperson, and here we talk about the member decide. So it's just a drafting style here. And then, with that drafting style, if you go back to Rule 30, when we talk interruption, suspension, adjournment of proceedings, it says the proceedings of this House or a committee of this House shall be interrupted, suspended, adjournment, decided. I don't know if you have amended that rule yet, Rule 30, because it looks to me like it's a repeat of 135 somewhere. And there you say by the presiding officer. And here you talk of a member presiding. Now, is there a different connotation to that? I think it's a drafting style. It's something we'll have to look at. And all committee. For a committee of this.
Okay. I can only think in response to that the member presiding as opposed to the chairperson would be that it could be an acting chairperson at a given moment or something like that. So I don't think they want to use presiding officer because that confuses the presiding officers of the House.
You use it in a rules that preceding this, you say the chairperson, and it's an acting chairperson, you become the chairperson.
I think acting chairperson is going to be a
I just wanted to say, because the framework in which in Rule 30 is more specific than in Rule 135. And I think we should try to make it magic. The issue that I wanted to raise was specifically in terms of Rule 135 was the resumption of the business. Now, of course, if it is cancelled, the resumption, due notice must be given.
Yeah.
And that is the problem, because we've got the date list with the committee, but it's chopped and changed, and it says not final, whatever, on the list. So there's always a lot of things that can happen. And I think sometimes committee members are not 100% aware that things have changed.
An allegation for against the member.
Yeah.
Can I clarify there? Let's just assume we're talking about a particular committee and an individual is being accused. A member of that committee is being accused of having a financial interest in something that he or she is discussing. Now, how are you going to deal with that member participating in the rest of that meeting? You know, we know that as members of parliament, you should, in fact, if you know you have a vested interest, you should declare that interest. This member is indicating that they're not too strong. There's an allegation that they are. How does that poor chairperson deal with that situation? Because obviously, if a member may be, they shouldn't be present, but it could also be a ruse to get somebody out of a meeting because they're going to bring information that the other individual doesn't want. So it's a very difficult situation. Perhaps what you need to then do, if something like that, I think, it may not need to be written in yet, maybe a procedural thing, but I think that it may need to go down somewhere. But then under those circumstances, that whole issue should then be referred back until the matter has been dealt with, in other words, the matter has been reported to the speaker and you've dealt with it. I think it would be unfair to send somebody out who perhaps doesn't believe they are, have any sort of vested interest or something. But you have a problem.
But the
committee dealing with it is one thing. Whether the member can remain present or not is... No, but strictly speaking, if an allegation is brought against the member, that's what I'm saying. Do you just continue as if nothing happened? That's what I'm asking. I'm asking how do you do it?
No, I don't think so.
Sorry, I just wanted to come back to the word charge. We use the word charge when we talk about substantive motions, we say properly substantiated charge there as well. So...
There's a slightly different context. Obviously, a charge against the court is an allegation as well, but the charge is a specific legal formulation. Now, you're not, when you're reporting to the speaker, putting it in a specific legal formulation. You're making a general report. So I don't think the word charge is in this context appropriate.
I would suggest that we look at something like if any allegation against a defendant comes before a committee, we should look at saying the chairperson should refer the matter to the speaker without delay, but allow the member to participate. Because why I'm very sensitive about that, it's far more difficult if there are just hollow allegations leveled at members of the opposition to get them out of the committee. It is usually, there are other mechanisms to use. If you know, say for instance, some of the a member in a committee has a very important, and it's usually the majority, because remember they determine arms deal and all of that. So if you think you should take the responsible route to write to the speaker to say we have substantive information, we're going to bring this matter before the National Assembly, we afford you an opportunity to investigate the matter beforehand, blah 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 blah. But I'm concerned if it's an allegation against any member, it can be used as a tactic to get rid of people in the committee before any substantive information has in fact been taken. So I would be very, very uncomfortable if we insist that member must leave.
I think the ladies would be oversensitive, but the member must leave. If any information or allegation against comes before committee, the committee may not proceed upon that information, but must report to the speaker without delay. Now, you know, that's exactly what it says. You can write things in for what reasons?
I thought what Ms. Sitting was trying to say was, if this allegation has a direct bearing on the matter before the committee, should the committee continue with the issue?
That's the point.
Should the committee continue with the issue, or should it suspend the consideration of the issue or refer the matter to the speaker? Yeah, I think that's the point she was saying. But I also wanted to make the point that investing is innocent until proven guilty. So you must balance those issues.
Chair, what we're talking about is, I think, is two separate issues. One is if there is a business before the committee, can proceed if it's a business that is proper, that the committee is properly mandated to deal with.
Yeah.
The problem is when there's a vested interest. That's what Mrs. Singh raised. If a member of that committee is accused of having vested interest in the business before the committee, how does the speaker, how does the chairperson of that committee deal with that? And I think there's something in the Code of Members' Interests which requires of them to declare any vested interest in the matter before and then recuse themselves. And so, if then the issue is raised in relation to a member of the committee in a committee meeting, I think my advice to the chair would be ask that member face to face, do you have a vested interest in this matter? If so, please recuse yourself.
Yeah.
And then you have to accept the member's good faith when the member says yes or no.
Yeah.
And then if the member says no, that member can participate, but it can still be investigated.
Yeah.
If the member says actually yes, then please recuse yourself. So I think that's how the way to do it.
You're right, Mr. Ali is right. There are two separate issues here. There are two separate issues. And when you start writing in the rules for both of them, I don't know, but I've got no problem with the way that it's done.
Yeah. I know what you're saying, but I would prefer if we just clarify what should be done.
Chairperson, bonus comes up. All I'm saying, and I refer specifically to vested interest, if that information does involve vested interest, how does the speaker proceed? I think Mr. Hanick's proposal is the right one. All I'm saying is there's got to be, I don't think it should just be left to the individual to have to, I personally, if I feel there's a vested interest, I would get myself up. And I think it's the best thing to do. But not everybody thinks that way. But the chairperson is in a difficult situation because it says specifically may not deal with the issue. So even asking the person actually is dealing with the issue, I think. So, you know, it's a bit of a problem situation. But I think you've got the gist of what my concern is.
I have a problem with this because it's an allegation. It's an allegation. And as Mr. Counselor said, innocent until proven guilty. Now, it's always left to the discretion of the chair to make the call. And I think, you know, if you're the chairperson, then you have those competencies. But to say to a member, you have a vested interest in the matter at hand based on an allegation, and therefore you should recuse yourself, is absolutely wrong. So if you're going to put it in, it
will
be causing problems. I
would
leave it as
a tick. I just want to read to the committee, I think, Article 12 of the Code of Conduct in the joint rules. It says the title here says declaration of private interest to parliamentary committees and forums. A member must declare any personal or private financial or business interest that that member or any spouse, permanent companion or business partner of that member may have in a matter before a joint committee, a committee, or other parliamentary forum of which that member is a member. And the member must withdraw from the proceedings of that committee or forum when that matter is considered, unless that committee or forum decides that the member's interest is trivial or not relevant.
That should be
brought
into the rules of the National Assembly. It's important. Then it is up to that, and then there's no need for the chairman to ask any questions. The moment somebody raises something like that, it is up to that member to say, I do have an interest, or to just proceed. But if it's written into the rules, we know very clearly that you're not allowed to.
Has the code as an annexure to the rules, so that when the code is adjusted, it is not necessary to rewrite the rules. If it is a if it is an annexure,
it
should have been.
It is in the general plan.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is it should have been part of here as well.
Let us proceed. And then I think we'll summarize the issue. I think we know the essence of what has come to us, but it's a fine set already. If a matter around the mining is ready to interest somewhere in fishing industry, and the matter is before the committee, surely we shouldn't doubt your confidence. You must refuse yourself if there's interest.
Yeah.
It shouldn't really come that you are saying that, no, this member for this interest here, I think it's another allegation that that must have to do with this.
I will never forget the minister of health, one of the previous ministers of health, one week the mic was got up and had a go at the Minister of Health and really had a go to the bus and investigated. And she came back and said something about coffin, putting nails in the coffin. So we had a business in the coffin business. Remember that? And he said, you have this coffin business.
Thank you, Shepard. Chairman, I just have a concern about this rule and the way it's being interpreted. I think it's being interpreted very narrowly, that it's just a conflict of interest in meetings, because there's already a rule in the joint rules. What, for example, if someone alleges misconduct of a member in relation to flouting the rules or not declaring something, or that then this rule wouldn't apply anymore. So then in terms of what would that member then be? So that's just my case of interpreting it very narrowly at the exclusion of any other misconduct or something wrong.
Okay. Now, I think that we should do. You understand what you're trying to say. Put it on where it is. Any proposal that you want to reach out to the issue, that will make the essence of my chance to make this different proposal. And then I think the support team is here to assist us on that. And from time to time, intervene and assist us to improve the language where the language is not. We are informed by your Matt Ellis experience of 22 years as a member of Parliament. 24. Oh, okay. I'm 19.
He's an old man.
Your experience on the reporting,
On Rule 137 reporting, and that is perhaps a prime example of a very good rule which is being disregarded to an alarming extent. And therefore, again, the issue of danger arises. Is the rule okay? Do we need to bring practice closer to the rule? Or is the rule wrong? Is it being too idealistic? Is it best practice
taken too far? Yes, the rule has got many subsections, and as I said, that subsection 2 is very nice, but my problem is with sub 4. A committee may not submit minority reports except they provide for these rules.
Yep.
We'll come across it later on in the legislative process when we talk about reporting on bills. It comes through again. It goes to the heart of what we have with the nomination of members to the PAP and the nomination of members to the Senate, where we have three from the opposition parties are both. And it goes to where the majority party can decide on which minority party members will get into that. Effectively, they can do that. Because the House decides who is elected to the panel, but the opposition members, but the majority can decide which opposition. Now, this rule here, when we talk about, it goes further, as I say, when we pick it up. They may not submit minority report, but they submit minority views in a report. So they might not, it allows the minority views later on in your report. And our dilemma here was, who decides what minority views get into a majority report?
kind of debate. You might want to have it here, you might want to have it later when we deal with the committee report, the legislative process.
Yeah.
Who decides what minority views goes to majority?
Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm going to deal with it here. I can deal with it later as well. But I mean, this, why can we not submit a minority report or a minority view? Why can a minority view not be included in a committee report? The current situation is the committee report comes before Parliament because we objected to it, we are allowed to make a declaration, but your views are not recorded in that committee report, and I think that's wrong. Delete that section or allow for a minority report to be included in a committee.
I want to go further to say that the rule as it currently stands is unconstitutional because it flies in the face of section 57 sub 2 B, which says the participation in proceedings of the assembly and that is how the rule should be formulated. Participation in proceedings of the assembly and its committees of minority parties represented in the assembly in a manner consistent with democracy. Now, there can be no misunderstanding of what that means. It means the views must be heard. So, this rule is unconstitutional as it stands. It should either be just deleted, or it should be included, minority views to be included. And I mean, they can suggest, even if it's an annexure or whatever, to a reportable committee. But those committees, for those parties who want to submit a written document, that should be contained in the report. Thank you.
Yeah. I just want to distinguish between, just say for example, the DA, there's a difference between a report on its own and a view of a party. So, so for example, this rule doesn't seem to permit, the DA can't submit its, but basically, this rule is saying that as a part of a committee report, the Democratic Alliance can't attach its own specific views as part of that report. Okay. And the views are that should be allowed. Okay, I'm just trying to get my head around this.
Exactly the same provision as is contained in the reporting on bills.
Yeah.
251.3e says that not a unanimous report on the bill. The committee must specify in the report in which respects there was not consensus, and in addition to the majority report, express any views of a minority in the committee.
Yeah.
So if you reflect, and that is really to assist debate in the House and to inform members of the contentious issues that came before the committee. They were resolved democratically by the majority in the committee, hence the majority report, if you like, but the committee is informing the membership generally of the House of the issues on which there was disagreement and what kind of disagreement there was.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure why it was. I was in on this when this was drafted. I never fully bought into the exclusion in 137 that is included in 251, but I had to accept the majority view on that one as well. My problem then is if you go to the inclusion of minority views, if, for example, you get a bill, say you have a report on a bill, and the opposition, the DA or co, have specific objections to the bill, which they want in the report, and it's political issues, so they want it phrased in a specific way. They don't want it phrased in this way, they want it phrased in that way. The majority party still decides what in what way those views will be reflected in the report. So even though it's minority views, they're being put in a way that the majority wants. So we're talking about different things when we're saying that a report of a committee can be tabled with annexures of committee views
being expressed in the words that that committee actually wants. And what then does it mean when such a report goes to the House? You can't have the House adopting, for example, the minority annexure of a report. So we're talking about who decides on the wording of a minority opinion in a majority report. Is it the majority, or is it the DA, or is it Cope? In terms of which opinion, exactly the wording of which opinion gets reflected in a report. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Jim, I was skeptical, very, very clever, because Kamala told me what to say, but Mr. Hunley got it first.
I think it's a case of recording the actualities of the meeting. If you accurately report on what has been said, and you know, I accept you're not saying so-and-so said this, then you've got the gist of it. I don't think it should be up to the party to count exactly what the wording would be. I think it is up to the committee to control exactly what the wording would be. But the point is, it must reflect the feelings of that minority party. And I think that is correct.
And Mr. Come up and let us move on.
We should just be consistent. 251 3E1, which is exactly the right rule that we should be looking at to incorporate here as well.
Yeah. In the group that
one, that's the point that was raised earlier on. It's just the report, though, that is presented to the House is a report of the committee. That the decision is taken by majority of members in that committee. There is no way that majority of members will also catch a fee that don't reflect their views as majority members in the committee.
You are respecting the issue.
We can say that my IFP raised this concern and this concern is fine.
That's
we can do that. But you can't write as a majority party in the committee and so say no, also write you what you have said. No. We will raise an issue. Of course, there's an objection, 1, 2, 3, 4, this part and this part. But the report is a report of the majority of members in that particular committee.
And that's the problem, you know, very often what this is used, what used to happen when I was doing Parliament is that you totally adverse to something specific and you oppose it. And then the committee chairperson would say, no, this goes through as it's been proposed. Approved. No, so many voted for, so many voted against, there was opposition to it. So I used to actually go so far as I was just saying to Mark earlier, I used to say, I wish to have my vote recorded again. So the only way I could actually make sure that something negative came out in the meeting, you know, and that is not the route you should be having to go to. You need to be able to say there were differences. That's all we say.
There's another point that we're different from that majority of course is this decision. Otherwise you also just subject the majority to minority rules. It can't work in a lot. Majority in the committee rules prevail. We'll cover problems. I don't say anything. We'll cover these little issues and concerns raised by the parties. And fine. We can't say, no, this is point rule, I think we'll be very much.
My son raised the issue of the report being adopted. Yeah. In the case of reports on bills, what comes before the House for adoption is the first one, and not usually the report on the law. And that's, I think, why they followed this different route in 137.
Yeah.
But when the report of a committee on any other matter than a bill comes before the House, what the House does when it adopts a report is it approves any recommendations contained in the report. It does not, in the process of adopting the report, necessarily reflect agreement with each and every point made in that report. The report is the report of the committee. What the House adopts are any recommendations it makes to the House.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a very nice idea.
Of course, I accept the view that the committee is, you know, democracy must accept the majority opinion, and the committee is a functional unit. But it is interesting because some parliaments do accept minority reports, and those minority reports are written by opposition parties. And you know, parliament is about politics. Politics is about how you express yourself. So the question of how you capture actual opinions can be very important.
What do you want us to do?
All I wanted to say is we must think very clearly about this, because very often a reporter's table in which nominations are made are individual, as they have in the recent months. Now, those individuals are assuming a responsibility. They are appointed to a board. Some members did not agree with it. Okay, now, fortunately, we had the opportunity yesterday to record our names against appointments. But it's not always, maybe sometimes there's an individual amongst the list that members feel must first face criminal charges or whatever. We have such a person that we appointed at Parliament, I'm sorry to say. Facing criminal charges, he's appointed to ICASA Council, and the point is now, it's actually an embarrassment for the Parliament, but members of the opposition should have been able to raise issues, etc. Now, say for instance you have something like that, where else will you record that other than do you stand up in the House and say, we object to this, this is the concern, whatever?
Yeah.
Because somehow you have to distance yourself visibly in the records of Parliament.
You did it yesterday. Was it yesterday? Yeah. You do that in your House, but it's late, you have you, and it's sending you on the main call. No government party or majority anywhere in the world will cover you are sending you. There's no way that you can do that. In the House, that's all you're allowed to make a declaration, and then you stand up and you declare. We don't want this to go so as corrupt or whatever. So it is your view here on that. But the main is that the report is the report of majority of members in the committee. And then you are given a space in the House and to say whatever you want to say. I thought really there's no issue so much about this.
Okay.
What do you want to do there? General power. People are either able to.
Just to point out, Chair, that petitions are included, and they receive petitions 138B, and you know, I think the suggestion that petitions should all go to one committee. This indicates clearly, and I think correctly, that any committee may receive a petition within its mandate.
Yeah. Any committee can receive it. What happened to our petitions committee? Is on hold?
Yeah,
we're
having a petition office now.
No, we still have a petitions committee, but it deals with special petitions.
Yeah.
You know, not with private members' bills.
Right.
Well, that committee deals with both private members' bills,
yes.
Or legislative proposals, sorry,
mm.
and special petitions. But now it can only deal with special petitions.
Mm.
Petitions of a general nature are referred to the relevant committees. If it has to do with housing, it will go to the housing committee. NCOP, I think, has a different. This is, I think, an anomaly, and I can't explain it. The general powers for committees does not include that it may consult any other committee. Whereas if you go to the subcommittee, the general powers for subcommittees, which is Rule 141, if you just compare that, the subcommittee on 1C, may consult any assembly or council committee or subcommittee or any joint committee or subcommittee. A subcommittee may do that, but it's empowered to do that. But a committee of the National Assembly is not.
That
is conferring with 139 is conferring with any other committee of the assembly specifically. Whereas the subcommittee is with any other committee or subcommittee or joint committee or other of the other house and so on, it's very different. And I'm not clear at all why that should be said.
Okay.
Yes,
just to add to that, with Rule 159, I know that the joint Rule 147 allows for any committee to confer with the NCOP committee. So perhaps that could be written in just to cover the nominee, Mr. Hunter's reference.
Okay, good. Do that. You want to make a point?
No, okay, that's the point.
Is that one I want to make?
It's a joint
rule.
It is only one concern, Chair, that we cannot write into our rules, into the National Assembly rules, that may confer with the NCOP committees without the NCOP agreeing to that. So it would be subject to the NCOP agreeing and putting the similar rule on their side, that their committees may consult any NA
committees. Because if the control committee is dealing with supplementary equipment that flies in this flight, surely those committees will not be able to comply. And also, they should be able to clean up.
Why did we jump to 1-3-1? Did we do the
1-3-1? Now, when you talk about procedure, you mean effectively rules. Now, no committee in my experience in this part of it has its own rules. I mean, there are rules in the rule book, but no committee has adopted its own rules. So, is that necessary? Would that be applicable anymore? I'm just wondering.
You can say may determine its own program, but you cannot allow the committee to adopt its own procedure. Clearly, you can't allow that because it must. It's part of the assembly, the structure of the assembly, and therefore the rules apply to everyone equally. So I just wanted to say that, and then when we move to 138, I've got the
point. If a committee invites Honorable Carrier to come before, can't really determine his own procedure to do that
much. The procedure is not meant to say rules. First of all, the committee is subject to these rules.
Yeah.
It may not amend processes that is in conflict with these rules.
Yeah.
So the procedure referred to here is the way it goes about conducting its business. Not just the program, but the order in which it's going to do it, which members are going to speak first, second, and third, and when, how many questions are going to be asked. So it's all of these arrangements that it makes to get its business done within time frames as well, but you know, in other perspectives as well. What is it going to do? How is it going to go about a particular task? Who is it going to call in? So all of these matters of how it engages in its business, whether it wants to have recordings made of a particular issue or not, all of these possible internal arrangements of the committee, if you like, is the procedure that are intended, and not rules.
Internal arrangements.
In terms of that's the operation of the committee, they decide, you adopt the minute at the end of the meeting, or I think those are procedural issues that the committee must be able to do. And then if people come to hear four of you, you may decide procedural rules to start in the committee meeting, not to hear about the rules at all, just for the operation of the committee that
point in the
so
we're
going to
allow the DA to actually have
school. Absolutely. Even to forbid them another
report.
But the internal arrangement, there's another problem though that we used to have internal arrangement committees or those things. But we'll find a better way of putting it. I think I shall find something that we have to do.
I think we understand the
essence of what you are trying to do. Yeah, yes, sir.
I was going to say, just to read the constitution as it relates to the NA, please. The NA may determine and control its internal arrangements, proceedings, and procedures. And then goes on to say, make rules and orders. So it's clear that procedures and rules are different issues. It's not the same issue.
Okay, let us touch right.
Can we just meet up 138? B and D should kind of follow each other.
B
is receive and D is permit. And then I think conduct public hearings. So it's just orderly.
Do we want to raise
Jefferson, I was wondering, it looks like it was introduced at some stage, and what is the history of this specific provision? But secondly, if I can just say in the heading, we should probably do the same adjustment as we've done before, and that is the members deciding to change it to Jefferson. But can you perhaps just have an understanding where this comes from, and is it the right spot?
I forgot to explain, and then the member of the public comes before the room.
It appeared to me that the rule itself, the body of the rule, is actually one long quote. It's the actual, oath that has to be taken. So the heading is not a heading. It should be a heading. So what we need to do is to create a heading now.
Yeah.
And this spot in bold should become part of the beginning of the text of the rule itself. You follow me?
Okay.
The history of this, of course, is not the Parliament Commission. When the Parliament Commission Act came into being, then we had to abolish the immunity for people giving evidence in front of court. So you said now then. But the broader question is, and we've debated this with House Chair and colleague also, the broader question is, when you summon someone, in terms of the summoning of the Parliament Privileges Act, you granted this immunity, so you have the sway, we understand what they're doing. What happens to other people who come before the committee? What happens to someone who comes there and is talking to you and wants to tell you something, and are they aware of their rights? That was our question. Do you have immunity if they come there on any issue without administering this oath? And that was a legal question I think we were looking for there. Let's say someone else offers themselves, you don't summon them, they offer themselves to say something. Are they allowed to be privileged in the committee? Or is it a normal privilege in terms of the constitution, freedom of speech, no immunity granted? Or is there something needs to be built in for people other than those who are summoned and serve as witnesses in front of the committee?
Well, we should look at that. So that led us to exactly the rules we could read then. Because my main worry would be when I would edit the volunteer to appear before the committee. And it's saying something that would really not think the committee would give it that amount, but is exposed for things which was not covered by the rules. But also what happened if edits if they come before the committee and lie about it, another person. And in fact, I mentioned that the individual who can't be before the committee to defend themselves. It is a much more complex issue. Oh, but then let us try to find a better way to protect people who come voluntarily before the committee.
I think this rule has to be understood in the context of the Powers and Privileges Act. It is only applicable in the case of certain work being done by a committee. If a committee is getting information in as part of its oversight work, it calls in a DG of a department or an official or somebody else. It's not going to insist on the oath being taken. I think that, you know, it just says speak the truth and nothing but the truth and so on. It's not of that kind of, pitched in that kind of way. Mm-hmm. So I think that this is really intended for particular and formal hearings by committees, but that's just, that's off the top of my head. I have to go to the Powers and Privileges Act.
But it's not that something that happens particularly a conventional system where people are called for committees of inquiry.
Right.
In the defense issues that happen, killing everywhere, then the minister is called upon another witness to appear before the Congress Committee. Then they take an oath for that to be protected. So they can divulge information anyway, that was a testing from that. Therefore they must be protected as accordingly. But if people really voluntarily, they're almost like whistleblowers. They say, no, I want to appear before the committee, but very specified information to divulge.
and they come in, you must balance it though. You cannot have people who are very genius. And come before the comment and say Sybil is running their process. And she's not doing that in the army, she's a nice competition. And then come to a person because the process has already. When a person comes before the comment and laughs, I think we should find a better way of balancing the two. And then I'm not sure how to do it, but I think the lawyers are here. They will assist us with it.
Maybe I just want to ask Joe that the legal services office looks at giving advice on this in terms of how do we cover people who are not specifically summoned and who want to give evidence? Should we protect them in some way? In what circumstances do we require an oath to be taken in a committee, in essence? If the legal services office can give us the advice on that.
Okay.
Can you
refer
the matter to that?
Yeah.
Could you?
I just wanted to have clarity on the issue of a person to be summoned. By the way, sub 13A, I think the wording there just needs revision. Before it to give evidence, it is not under oath or affirmation. But anyway, be that as it may. We've had a problem as committee with some of the departments coming before the committee, presenting evidence, and upon further investigation at a later stage, we became aware that we were not given honest information. Now, at one stage, we tried to charge the DG. We had to get legal services to tell us what are our powers, etc., and in the end, we couldn't do anything about it. Now, I thought it was actually a very serious transgression to mislead Parliament. Where is that captured? Committee powers in as much as that? Because actually, if you don't have that, actually Parliament becomes without any teeth. So how do we ensure that specific oversight role of departments reporting to us misleading us, and later on we find out that they were misleading us. How do you hold them accountable? And I just wanted to know exactly how do we and where do we do that?
I think that's specifically covered in the Powers and Privileges Act.
Yes.
And it's contempt of Parliament as an offence if any witness before any committee which is incorrect or false information intention. And so if a committee becomes aware of the fact that knowingly false information has been supplied to a committee, they can lay a charge of contempt of Parliament. And if it applies in this case to an outside person as opposed to another member, the process would follow the legal process outside of Parliament in the courts of
criminal charge. Is that a criminal charge?
In terms of the Parliament of the
Act. Yeah, but would that be registered to the NPA, basically?
So also the committee also has the option of including that information into the report to the House. And once the report is adopted, the matter is referred to the responsible minister.
Okay, now that's fine.
But nothing
happens. Yeah, nothing happens. Let us move to 5.3. Hold up the table.
On the conferring, I know that there have in the past been some problems where sometimes a committee is instructed to confer with another committee, and that other committee proves not to be available for any kind of formal conferral. So the nature of that conferral has been problematical at times, and does a written response from another committee constitute conferral? Those are some of the kind of problems that I think have arisen, but I'd like to know from anybody from the committee section who can advise on the kind of problems that you're facing in that regard. I know that in one case, and this goes back away, the committee reported that it could not proceed. It had been instructed to confer with another committee. It found it over weeks impossible to get together with that other committee until finally it reported to the program committee, and the program committee said to them, if you've tried and you've got evidence that you tried didn't go ahead and I was off control. But so those can be issues sometimes.
Okay. Anyone can ask it from the
I wish we should extend the conferring to beyond just the committees sitting physically together. Maybe it should be possible for a committee to convey its views on a matter in writing to the committee.
Yeah.
Would
that be
useful?
That
has been practiced.
Yeah.
And we should just codify the practice.
Okay.
139,
any other issue there? We are fine. 5-3, the rules are applicable to the subcommittee in general. Any issue there, Felix?
For me, it's concerned that I shall not apply at least 30 minutes.
Well said, Michael.
These rules on the subcommittees 140 through to 149 are very detailed again, amazingly detailed, and I think the intention was to make sure that these subcommittees function within proper managed controls. If there's no other problems, I just want to refer to 143, term of office. The members of a subcommittee are appointed by the parent committee, that's the requirement. But in 143, sub 3, it says that the member of a subcommittee ceases to be a member and an alternate for a member ceases to be an alternate if a whip of the party to which that member or alternate belongs gives notice to the speaker in writing that the member or alternate is to be replaced or withdrawn. It's the whip of the party that has to inform the speaker of the withdrawal or replacement of a member. I'm confused why, since it's the parent committee that appoints the members to the subcommittee, why shouldn't it be the parent committee that then informs the subcommittee about replacement or withdrawal? It doesn't make sense to me that that has to go by a whip since
the members. In other words, the way I understand it is that if the whip of the party wants to change something, they've got to communicate the chair of that committee.
Parent committee.
Sorry. Is that the reality? I mean, let's say I was to be taken off this committee. Does my chief book have to inform you because you're the chairperson of the subcommittee, or does he inform the chair of the rules committee?
It seems to me that good practice would be that since you were appointed by the rules subcommittee onto this task field, that if you're to be replaced, the subcommittee should be informed of your replacement. And
that's
sorry.
Then good point. 141A, 2A, indicates that the subcommittee appoints them. So therefore, the subcommittee should make the changes to it.
Okay. The current committee, the follow committee sometimes, the rules committee. And I think it's a point that is important. Otherwise, really, the current committee appoints people to serve. And then we simply take away those people who are appointed by the parent committee, not even the parent committee, so the letter goes direct to the speaker, and then but they are appointed by the parent committee, and I think it would make sense to.
In actual fact, what Martin has to say, I think pretty long at least, that being appointed, if you've been notified, if the parent body does not necessarily know,
yeah,
the speaker has,
that's what called by the parent committee. the one way that is informed.
Yeah.
And then that salary will be put then in from the street.
And presumably the members will be informed along with them too.
The parent committee, the intent of the speaker, in fact, the speaker anyway, is a person who is not able for that committee, should be informed. That we are withdrawing so and so, and that is definitely informed the speaker. That is never so and so has been withdrawn by his party from the subcommittee of this parent committee. I think we won't be a problem between them.
So 143.3 will change.
Yeah.
Chairperson, because usually communication is with the speaker by the whippery of the party. So I'm a little, you know, yes, the parent committee, whatever we call it, must be informed as well. But it is not a question of copying them and just the speaker remaining sort of the original person to communicate with. So I just feel that we should also, in terms of the rules, just remain consistent. That you know, the whiffery and it will communicate to the speakers. So I'm
worried. Chairperson, I actually support that because if those names originally had been announced in the 80s, it's got to be announced. The change has to be announced. The only way the change is going to be announced is if it goes to the speaker, not if it goes to the chairman.
I thought that what we are trying to say is that Sandy will go through Macaulay.
Yeah.
Can you say that Honorable Macaulay, we are withdrawing what's in this subcommittee. And therefore, then Macaulay will then write a letter for my to the speaker. That's what you want to ask.
I'm talking now from the days when I was in the whippery. We would not have done it that way. We might have informed the chief whip verbally, but it would have been the speaker. We might have even sent a copy to the chief whip. But it would have been the speaker that we have written to, because we want to ensure that the correct documentation goes through, so that on the ATC it will be shown correctly. You've got to make sure that your part is in the clear.
No,
so I
do have to think that I made my call a bit wrongly.
Yeah.
I was not talking to him as a chief whip.
Yeah.
I start saying that I'm a shepherd, not a committee. I'm human second. We meet, we appoint a subcommittee. It is only fair that the shepherd in of that parent committee must be informed that so-and-so in the subcommittee is being withdrawn. And then that shepherd then can forward a letter to speak. To say in this subcommittee that we've set up this thing. We can also do that with the CC to the chairperson of the committee.
So that's
part of
the CC
story.
Yeah,
the
reason why I raised this was in the case of a committee, a full committee, a portfolio committee or whatever, the speaker appoints the members and that gets announced in the ABC. But we're dealing here with a committee applying its powers to appoint a subcommittee.
Yeah.
And when it does so, it, the parent committee, must appoint the members of the subcommittee from amongst its members. So the whole appointment process is the parent committee identifying which of its members are going to serve on the subcommittee. So that if the intention is to withdraw a member, Ms. Cullen, from the task team, which has been set up and appointed by the subcommittee, the process would be that you would be replaced, presumably, by another member of your party on the subcommittee. Since the appointing agency is the parent committee, this is an internal working issue for the parent committee, rather than a complete replacement of a member on a committee. So that's why I raised it. It's an internal parent committee matter.
Committee is any point there? 144 is any point at
Thank you, Chair. Rule 140A.
140?
Yeah, 140A. I'm not sure what that means. The rule might know sense to me. I can't find it. I mean, it's like it's talking into maybe the table can tell me what that means. I mean, doesn't not make sense.
140A.
When we dealt with the parent committees, we discussed that rule extensively. So it's a similar rule to that.
Mm-hmm.
So we can explain to the colleague what it does.
Okay.
Not the point that I was mentioning, it's
just
a very extensive discussion.
Okay, what's done? Is it the same? Yeah, I
was just for these along the lines of that we did for the parent.
Again,
145, Chair, the acting chairperson, the subcommittee may elect another member. I think it should be must.
No.
In the
okay. So,
can I just talk to acting chairpersons? I mean, would we want to consider committees to appoint a chairperson and a deputy chairperson? So if one is not available, the other one is there, or are we happy to have this acting position?
The one concern I think has been in the past that if you appoint both the chair and deputy chair to ensure that there's always somebody in place. There are expectations of remuneration and things
okay.
like that, and expectations also if the chair goes that the deputy chair will replace and so on. So I think it creates those kinds of problems, and that may be the reason why they preferred the acting chairperson route.
Chairperson, then, does 145.2, surely if when you're talking must, is the acting chairperson will perform the function and must, surely that person must exercise the powers of the chairperson, not may. No, we're talking now two, not one. You said must under one. I'm saying must under two.
Well, the chair.
No.
The next one,
members and presenters at least 48 hours before the meeting.
long time.
Sure, 48 hours.
48 hours.
48 hours.
An hour before.
My
job.
48 hours, 2 days. Enough. Remember to go from Tristan.
Sorry, but I just feel, in all fairness,
No,
I think it's fine. But the point is, should we not put it in the rule?
The problem is, Mr. Bruce, I think we could have something like reasonable time, although that's difficult to implement. Because if you have, I mean, imagine a situation where you have an urgent meeting and you'd have to suspend the rule, otherwise the legitimacy of the meeting could be challenged.
Okay, you can revisit this one.
Actually, it is not as far as the subcommittees are concerned. It's only as far as the committees are concerned.
Yeah.
And I really want to suggest that we look at the reasonable, but that we specify the reasonable time, because that is where some of the problem lies. It's poor planning.
But if there is a meeting, then you should also qualify it. Yes.
But then you have to stipulate to say, in exceptional circumstances, you know, the rule can be sort of overcome by telephonic notices to members or whatever, something like that. But it is becoming a practice to just, you know, decide, chop and change, and, you know, and that shouldn't be allowed. We should formalize it.
Sorry, can I just clarify? We're talking about the main committee, so we're talking rule 132.
You know, I don't know whether it's the exception or the rule that meetings, committee meetings, are haphazard. I mean, that's why there's a red list, and it comes out every week and every day, and you look at it. I mean, poor admin, I don't think should be written into the rule. And that's just my. And you see, and the other thing is, the program of Parliament is so, it changes so quickly. You know, 1 week we have a sitting, then we make up our mind and decide we're not having a sitting, but there's a gap there and you want to fill it. And I think by being too prescriptive, we're going to do ourselves more harm. I know you may have experienced some problems in the committee that you have worked in, but in the main, I think the schedules are there, and I would hate to see admin problems becoming a rule.
Okay, now I think that the principle we have upset. That all this, what you want to say to
you? All I'm saying is, I don't think you are creating rules to overcome admin problems. You actually create rules and then make provision for proper administration to apply the rules. Yes. Now, that is why I'm saying, if you have such a manual, but it doesn't have any status as a manual, then it's a nice to have, but it doesn't have any meaningful impact.
Okay.
Except for possibly 149, 148, 149.
matters relating to quorum now.
No, we are through on that.
We are through on that.
Yeah.
From the earlier.
Unless there's an issue that you want to raise.
From the earlier discussion.
Yeah, so yes, but these are subcommittees, so
yeah,
they can meet whatever, there's no quorum necessary.
Ah, thank you for reminding me. Okay.
Oh. And then decisions, very happy to be here.
Yes,
thank you. There's nothing that says that manual team goes to the
committee. It's decided by consensus.
Consensus cannot be reached. All views of the subcommittee on this must be reported.
But this is a committee, there's a committee reporting to a parent committee. For a parent committee to take an informed decision.
I'm very keen.
I'm very happy about that. But it's not a parent committee. Yes, that's on. Now, we are covered. 149 general powers. Any issue there? No issue.
I think it's just perhaps important to emphasize that the subcommittee does not automatically have the powers of the main committee unless they are specifically assigned.
Yeah. I think we should do that because they can just as do they have all the powers that they need to.
Yes, the powers listed in Rule 1, 3, and only when assigned in terms of these rules. So does that mean, all by resolution, which is another matter, does that mean because the rules do assign it?
So the powers assigned to the subcommittee are the general rules.
Rules 1 through 8.
Let me see.
That is applicable to the committee.
It's only
assigned. Does that mean
only by House resolution?
No.
By these rules, or by House resolution. So, to the extent that some of those calls are assigned to a subcommittee, the subcommittee does have those powers. But if they are not assigned,
that's
good. Do you assign these rules or House resolution?
Can I just perhaps pick up on this? Rule 138, which is the rule referred to now, is the general powers of committees, of the main committees. And this one under 41.49, general powers of subcommittees, said it has the powers listed in Rule 138, i.e. the powers of the main committees, only when assigned to it in terms of these rules. So if these rules, in with reference to a particular committee, do not say, and the subcommittees of the of SCOPA or whatever other committee has the powers under 138, then it will not have those powers.
So what happens if you have a committee on portfolio committee that wants to have hearings, public hearings throughout the country, besides wants to have the subcommittees because it's got a very busy program, so it splits into two, has public hearings in different provinces. You're saying it's not allowed in terms of these rules because 138 says general powers subcommittee says to conduct public hearings. So the subcommittee is not allowed to conduct public hearings unless it's by House resolution.
Yeah. Interesting. That's true.
I've just looked at the portfolio committees and the rule 203 is the subcommittees are portfolio committees. And the portfolio committee may appoint a subcommittee from among its members to assist the committee. It says nothing about it having the rule 138 powers in the process.
Well, that's the question. Should it or shouldn't it?
Not.
The
subcommittee. Conduct public hearings, maybe not public hearings formally, but going to a community and discuss issues with the community, that's a form of public hearing, it's about public engagement. But in terms of these rules, that's not permitted.
Well, I think we should try to capture one of the areas, because the parent committee, we can first divide ourselves into three. Go to this province and this province and this province, and conduct public hearings. Sometimes time is ahead on that, but the subcommittee also should be given certain power. Somewhere we should escape it, and unless they're not given to them, they can't exercise those powers. So what we don't want to do is to just allow everyone to have similar power, subcommittees, parent committees,
I think we can call on the
kind of confusion. Will it probably be solved, Chair, if we say in 139 that in setting up a subcommittee, the parent committee can identify which powers it is giving to the subcommittee for purposes of this.
So in Rule 141, say that the parent committee or the subcommittee may delegate any of its powers to the subcommittee necessary for the subcommittee to perform its task.
Okay. Well, then 149 is
missed. We can then just put it around the
table. 141, sub-rule 2D.
Mm-hmm. 2D,
yeah.
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 Okay.
So
what do we do? Just a second, sir. You know that you are meeting next week, Thursday, and then before. Okay. Colleagues, I think we have tried all of our best, and it's not bad to move on this committee section. Is that the committee should assist us on some to make some proposal on some of the rules? That's what we expected. That because the application of these rules is with them almost on daily basis. There will add a rule that they have identified that not this rule
doesn't make it easy for the committee to work. They must be able to come here and say, in terms of this rule, this is what we are proposing. Because that's what in fact we expected from them, though we avoided complete a broad forecast statement. It was not going to assist us in terms of doing the rules. I think they must assist us that they look at Timos. Wherever possible, they must come, make some proposal on what we should deal with this one. We can then have discussion on some of the proposals. I think that's what we wanted to achieve. There's still a lot of work that needs to be done. We would rely on them also assisting us to facilitate the work of the committee. The reason why I wanted them to come before the committee is that they've got a lot of experience now. We may not really be sitting where they are located now. They may not even understand some of the issues that are difficult for them to operate. But if they come before us and say, in terms of this rule and this rule, we think we should consider amending this and this, if they do have waiting, they can make a proposal on that. That's what you wanted them to do. I think they must assist us on this. And I'll be very worried if it's broad forecast statement, but that doesn't take us anywhere. We want specific areas that we are reviewing the rules. And then bearing in mind that also we agree that these rules should stand the test of time. We should not amend the rule today, next day amend them, and next year, because there's no application of our own mind. That's why we wanted rules that to be amended and please stay with us for long, without being suspended every 6 months they have. And I think the committee would assist us a lot today to put things together. I think they've done a lot of research themselves around the working of committees. And then Naledi Pandora said, this rule must also assist us as to avoid the suspension, but also said that the rules should not be meant to control. They should facilitate the work of Parliament, not to control people in Parliament. I think they were raising this issue there. We're hopeful that in our next meeting, Castle, you know, the Chief General deals with committees, will assist us to identify some of the rules. They may not need to identify everything, but I think they will have rules that they think are very problematic in terms of efficiency and effectiveness of Parliament. Bear in mind that the Parliament is a tool, is an activist Parliament. The Speaker said the rule with that, the rules must also capture that. That is an activist Parliament, therefore, in the rules you must see this is an activist Parliament. Because in the next sense of our work, they should really assist us more than just broad statements, because they want us colleagues, I think we are meeting then. We have adopted our program at least. On the 27th, Thursday and Friday we meet. And hopefully, Sybil and Mike Ellis will be around. We are not going to be fishing somewhere and go to another bay.